Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc. Roundabout Theater Company presents an electrifying new production of Clifford Odets' classic, The Big Knife, at the American Airlines Theater on West 42nd Street in New York City. The show is currently in previews and officially opens this coming Tuesday, April 16th. This is the first Broadway revival of the 1949 play, which was adapted for the screen in 1955, produced and directed there by Robert Aldrich. In the play, directed by Tony Award winner Doug Hughes, Bobby Cannavale plays Charlie Castle, a film superstar stuck in the studio system of the 1940s. In the golden age of Hollywood cinema, actors may have all the glory, but the studio execs have all the power. It's a classic tale about keeping your integrity in the face of success. Richard Kind plays Marcus Hoff, the fast-talking, pressure-heavy head of the studio, and Chip Zion plays Nat Danziger, Charlie's loyal agent. Chip Zion's previous Broadway credits include, but are not limited to, Falsettos, The Boy from Syracuse, Grand Hotel, and he played the Baker in the original production of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods. He's also appeared in numerous films and on television, and I spoke with him at the American Airlines Theater in New York City a few weeks ago. Chip Zion, welcome to the Roundtable.
That's great to be here.
So tell us about, for the listener who's not familiar with the show yet, just a brief overview, the sort of synopsis of The Big Knife.
The Big Knife is a play that was written in the late 40s. It's about the studio system in Los Angeles, an actor who's not happy to be a part of that studio system and wants out. That's Bobby Cannavale, who's unbelievable in the show. But I think the larger story is sort of the underbelly of the corporate world. It's a show almost about organized crime in a way, and I find that to be the most interesting elements of it. There's a big secret in the show. There's things that are being covered up. It's incredibly tense, and these arguments spill out in one confrontation after another.
And this isn't the first Odets play you've done on Broadway.
It isn't. I did The Country Girl a few years back with Mike Nichols, which was just an amazing experience. Morgan Freeman and Frances McDormand and Peter Gallagher, and it was an amazing time, too.
What appeals to you about his style of writing?
The language of Clifford Odets is very beautiful, at times poetic, and yet he's writing for sort of the common man, kind of the blue-collar guys, the immigrants who just got to the United States. And it's really interesting to kind of sit at home and dig into that language and try to make it your own. I to a certain extent, because I'm older, there are certain things that people say that I think I've heard my parents talk about. I mean, I was around in the early 50s, I was around. So it's really fun to look at that language, make sure you understand it, absorb it, and then try to make it real. I mean, there's interesting problems, you know, when you're doing Shakespeare or anything where the language is a little fancier than you might speak in normal talk. But yet, I mean, I have terms in the show where I refer to dollars as watermelons. So I talk about, you know, I have 3,744, you know, watermelons. There's a great feeling of absorbing that dialogue, and it's fun. And also, doing Odets in both of these instances, it's just full-body drama. And it's not, you know, a lot of things now, like, as I was saying to Cannavale the other day, I said, you know, can't we just do a simple, like, boy meets girl scene? A contemporary, you know, boy meets girl scene. We just say, hi, how are you? She says, I'm good. And then you have some conversation about what happened yesterday. It's not quite that.
The director is Doug Hughes. Have you worked with him before?
No, I haven't worked with Doug, but I've always wanted to. And I probably met Doug when he was like 7 or 8. He doesn't even know this, but I had the first show I did on Broadway was with his dad, Barney Hughes, one of the great New York actors and an actor that we all had admired through the years. And his mom, I was in a show called All Over Town with Barney Hughes on Broadway with Cleavon Little. Barney Hughes were the leads. And I was in Hotel Baltimore with his mom. Somewhere along the line, Doug was like hanging around the theater. So I've known him for a long time, but never had the opportunity to work with him. And he is really something. I almost want to direct, which I never did before, because actors are very difficult, and talking to them can be very complicated. And Doug has the nicest way of saying, you know, may I suggest, may I offer you this thought? And he has a whole language of approaching the actors, which I've never experienced, and it's incredibly gracious, and he's unbelievably prepared and bright about all of the material. He's been great. I hope I get a chance to do it again.
When did you decide that you wanted to pursue a career in the theater?
You know, I grew up in Milwaukee, and as much as you could have a stage mother in Milwaukee where there was limited theater, I had that. Uh-huh. My parents tell me that they were concerned that I wasn't going to have a hobby because I was a little short in stature, but extremely well proportioned, as a line in this show that says, I thought that line up, but there's actually a line in this show that says the same thing. So when I was really young, I could sing. I was like a little boy soprano, and it was kind of embarrassing, but my mom would drag me around to local TV shows. And I won, my first show business memory is that I won a giant box of potato chips on a local talent show in Milwaukee, singing a song called Down Yonder, Someone Beckons to Me. I can't remember the rest of it, but... And I was wearing a cowboy hat and, you know, six shooters, and I was playing like a little cowboy, which if you could see me out there in Radio Land, you know how ridiculous that is. So that was my first experience. And then as summer stock shows came through Milwaukee, I would always be in them. I was in South Pacific. I played the Jerome, the little Polynesian boy who sings Dites moi pourquoi la vie est belle, you know, and... But I veered off. I went to college. I wanted to go into politics, or, you know, I went to the University of Pennsylvania. I wanted to be a lawyer and maybe end up in Washington, D.C. And somehow my step... This is a long story. But
yeah, somehow, that's great.
Somehow my stepsister, who went to the University of Wisconsin, was running a theater in Chicago, and they ran out of... Somebody got sick. And because I had grown up, she knew I could sing all these songs. Anyway, my sister hired me to work at a theater in West Dundee, Illinois. It was kind of a dinner theater, and we did some very serious work, like John Dos Passos, USA Dos Passos, and we would come back from intermission, and half the audience was gone. I mean, it was just terrible. The end of the story is the theater burned to the ground one Sunday afternoon, and some of us got in a car and went to New York, and others went to Los Angeles, and... I ended up in New York because I'd gone to school out east, and some of those people who went to L.A. were never heard from again. But that's how I got myself to New York and started acting. And, I got a job. I got Charlie Brown right off the bat, Snoopy.
That's a fun role.
Yeah, it was fun. And, I was very lucky, and I was suddenly making money, and I thought, oh, this acting thing's a snap. But I really did at that point have to catch up. I studied hard at that point once I got to New York and realized that it was much more of a craft than I knew anything about. And so I consider myself very lucky that I had that springboard, but there was an awful lot of luck at the very beginning of my career. I might have just gone back to law school.
You played the baker in the original production of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods. That's a great credit. What has that meant to you? What did it mean to you at the time?
Well, it means everything. I mean, I think luck plays so much a part in people's careers, and... what had happened to me was there, Playwrights Horizons, a well-known off-Broadway theater and very successful to this day, was in its sort of infancy in that era. Andre Bishop, who now runs Lincoln Center, was running Playwrights Horizons, and Bob Moss, good, wonderful theater people. I got friendly with Bill Finn. He was doing a show called In Trousers, and they cast me as the lead in that show. And in fact, I was referred to, he was Big Bill, and I was referred to as Little Bill, because originally he had written it and played that part. So I met Bill Finn, and we became very close friends for our lives, for life. We're still very, very friendly and close, like family. Billy introduced me to Lapine at Playwrights Horizons, who he was working there, and Wendy Wasserstein, and this whole generation of young playwrights who were just at the cusp of becoming very successful. So Lapine ends up directing March of the Falsettos. Then I end up getting cast in the next production of, after it hadn't fared so well on Broadway, of Merrily We Roll Along, that went to La Jolla. The next thing I know, this is kind of cute, I get a call. I was doing a TV series in L.A., and I get a call saying that from Ira Weitzman, who produces all the musical theater at Lincoln Center now, and became a big force in finding all the new composers in New York. And he called me up, and he said, you know, James, I think wants to cast you in Into the Woods, but he said the casting process has been so crazy. I think if you tell him you're busy and you can't make it back for the audition, I think they'll offer it to you. And I said, that's a big risk, isn't it? And he said, I'll follow it along very carefully. James called me. He said, you know, could you fly back in and just to read for Steve Sondheim and me, and really desperately want to, but I'm the shooting schedule out here is crazy, and I don't know if I can make it work. And a few days later, he called and offered me the part, and it's like the, you know, it was Ira Weitzman a tremendous amount, and of course it was the greatest experience that anyone could ever have in the theater. I met Steve Sondheim, and I became a part of that family to a certain extent, and Joanna Gleason, who we had this unbelievable chemistry, and then to work on that show, and we did readings and workshops. We first did it in San Diego at the Old Globe, where Steve had to run out in the parking lot and tell people there was a second act. I don't know if you heard those stories. They actually added it just before intermission, a line that says, to be continued, because the first act, as people know the show, is really fun and up, and it's kind of a wonderful fairy tale, and the second act gets quite serious. Mm-hmm. People thought, well, they had just seen a complete show. It was beautiful, and in San Diego, they started leaving, so they had to be pushed back into the theater for act two.
And Stephen Sondheim went out and did that himself.
Well, in Steve's book, he claims that he sent somebody out there, but I was in the dressing room when this happened, and I am under the impression, Steve may be right, but I was told that it was Steve himself who went out into the parking lot and told people to come back into the theater. There was more. I could be wrong, but that was my impression at the time. I just did it this summer in the Delacorte. You know, I was originally the Baker. Right. I played the mysterious old man, the part that Tom Aldrich played in our original production. And I had a fabulous time, mainly because, one of the reasons was because I had a young group of actors who were completely trapped, and I could tell them all these stories, and they couldn't possibly get away from me. So I could.
I'm sure they didn't want to.
I could relive the whole thing, you know, and it was like really fun to do that, and also to be outside at the Delacorte, where the moon is coming up in the Belvedere. There's a castle behind an actual castle behind the set. So there was a great play going on behind the set as well as in front. Plus the fact there are wild animals that scurry around. There are raccoons that visited us almost every night. And even stole props. I was upset for them because there were plastic loaves of bread, which these poor raccoons ran off with. And I thought, like, I hope this doesn't hurt them and make them sick. But it was. But you could see the raccoons stealing our fake loaves of bread during Into the Woods. Anyway, it was great fun to do it again. And when it was revived in New York, before we did it at the Delacorte, Stephen DeRosa played the part that I had originated, and that was a terrible problem because we did here at the Roundabout. We were about to do Boys from Syracuse, and he was supposed to play my twin brother, and so they took him, and it got more complicated after. We were supposed to be twins.
Instead, you were the same person in a way.
I ended up doing it. The Boys from Syracuse is a very close friend, but we didn't. But Steve and I actually resemble one another. Yeah. So it was like, and we had done readings and workshops of it. Anyway, so but Into the Woods is the fact that I was involved is just astounding. And when Sondheim had his 80th birthday event at Lincoln Center, mm-hmm. Through the years I'd become very friendly with Mandy Patinkin. And Mandy's from Chicago. I'm from Milwaukee. Our kids, we used to do holidays together and stuff. And we were standing in the, you know, in Lincoln Center going like, he sang that beautiful song with Bernadette and the thing that he sings from Sunday in the Park. Yeah. And it was just breathtaking. And I had just, anyway, we grabbed each other and started to cry like we were 4 years old. Say, like, here we are, two little guys from the Midwest. He's not so little. And how the hell did we end up here? And how lucky were we to cross paths with Steve? And just the timing of all of these things is just astounding. I mean, Mandy, I did a show with Mandy called Split off Broadway at the very early, it was actually at EST. He didn't even at that point think of himself as a singer. You know, he would carry a guitar around and say, like, I'd like to sing. I'd like to sing in a show. And the rest is history. You know, I mean, like, you know, who's better? So, like, you know, it's such an amazing, you know, those were great, great days. And the fact that all of us overlapped in some way and came together, it's just the kismet and oddly fortuitous, you know, amazing.
You mentioned filming a television show before, and you've done, you know, quite a lot of TV and movies. Do you prefer the stage?
I've never been comfortable in front of a camera. I keep thinking I haven't done it enough, but now I'm in an age where I can't make that excuse anymore. It's like, because I have done it an awful lot. I think curiously, like for me, the best thing, I was on a TV series several years back where the scenes would come in late. And sometimes we'd be sitting on the set waiting for the actual scenes, and they were long and very wordy. And I was terrified that because we would just get handed pages of the script and then film it right away. Oddly, I look at some of those scenes. I think it's the best work I ever did. I'm really look like I'm desperately thinking, which is a good way to be when you're on camera. And I didn't have time to ruin it. I didn't have time to overthink it or make it something else that it wasn't. But I'm more comfortable on stage, and particularly, well, and because you revisit it every night. And you know, I've often said I'm really good in the third month of a run. And I'm also a guy who likes, I happen to like long, I've done long runs. I was in Into the Woods the whole time. I then went into Grand Hotel, did that for a really long period of, I like it. There's a contradiction in that you know, your blocking is all set, the words, everything is structured, but within that structure on stage, I feel a tremendous sense of freedom. I can't quite explain it, but that's, it becomes very real being on stage, and so I prefer it. And the other thing is that, I mean, in our family, the rule of thumb was if I ever had a series that went more than 2 years, my wife would we'd all move to California. And I never really made it beyond 2 years. But the show that I liked the most that I did was called Almost Perfect in the mid-90s. This is a ways back. And, you know, in a sitcom, like every few episodes, they feature one of the regular characters a little more than the others. And I did it, had an amazing episode where I got to work with Marie Osmond, which was one of my fantasies because I had always wanted to be Donnie. After the episode aired, and I thought it was great. I thought, this is it. I've got this thing whipped. I know what I'm doing. This was funny. This is great, great stuff. I went to my apartment. I toasted the Hollywood sign, which I could see out of my windows of my apartment. By myself, broke up with a bottle of wine, toasted the Hollywood sign, and we got canceled the next day.
Oh, no.
So that's the world of television for me.
Do you mind if I ask you about Howard the Duck?
Howard the Duck, an amazing experience. I didn't originally get it. I was the voice of Howard the Duck. That's what we have to clarify. A lot of people think I was actually in the duck suit. That isn't true.
Nobody thinks that.
I'm afraid people do. They think I was in, there was like a duck bag and I was like inside of it. That isn't true.
Okay.
I was the voice of the duck. It was a complicated thing. I was doing Merrily We Roll Along in La Jolla, as I mentioned earlier, and the casting director came back, and she said, you know, I didn't really care for the show that much, but interestingly, you sound to me like a duck. And I thought, like, that is just so insulting.
Yeah.
She said, you were auditioning this movie called Howard the Duck, and we need a guy who's the voice of a duck, and I think you're right for it. And I remember thinking, like, this is terrible. I've never been more offended. And a couple weeks later, I get a call from my agent saying, like, you know, they want you to come in for Howard the Duck. I said, I'm not doing it. They came backstage. I didn't like what was said to me.
Yeah.
And
it doesn't sound like it was handled with much panache.
No. So anyway, but the point of the whole, so I end up going in for this thing, and then I find out that, like, everybody in Hollywood's trying to get this is like a big deal. It's George Lucas producing, and and Willard Hike and Gloria Katz, a team that had written the Harrison Ford movies, the
Indiana Jones,
the whole Indiana Jones series. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. I was too quick to turn this down.
Oh, it's a duck from outer space. Yeah, okay, it's less like, insulting.
Wait a minute. This is cool. So I ended up auditioning maybe six times or so. And I was, by this time back in New York, I kept flying out. I didn't get it. Robin Williams got it, and he quit after the third day. The reason he quit was because you actually had to sync up to a duck bill that you looked as you were looking at the screen and looping this movie. And he just gave up. I got a call like on Memorial Day or what's saying like get on a plane, get out here. You're now Howard the Duck. And I saw more of the film than I had ever seen. And I thought this is not so good. But this is what I talk about. By the third day, I thought this is the greatest single film ever made in history. That I now think this is the greatest film ever made. And I called this, by the way, the Howard the Duck syndrome, which is every actor's willing suspension of actual careful thought. You give yourself up over to the character. And so we recorded. I for several months I was out in Lucas Land looping the voice of Howard the Duck, and by the time I left I thought it was the greatest thing ever done, and it was worth a huge amount of money. And it opened, and it was one of the biggest flops. And I have a friend who a writer who was in the office of Frank Price, who was the head of Universal at the time. He said he visibly saw the head of the studio walk to the window where there was a giant billboard of Howard the Duck, the movie, because it had just opened, and he said he actually saw the head of the studio shudder with fright. And he did get that head of the studio at that point. He got replaced. But I talk about it all the time. My son-in-law came up to me and he said, your voice sounds so familiar to me. There was a group of 12-year-olds, boys mainly, who grew up on it and loved it.
Yeah. Chip, thank you so much for making the time to speak with me today. It's been a real treat.
Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun. It's great to meet you.
Chip Zion is featured in Roundabout Theater Company's revival of Clifford Odets' The Big Knife, directed by Doug Hughes. The show is in previews now and opens officially this coming Tuesday, April 16th. To learn more, visit roundabouttheater.org. The run is scheduled to end on June 2nd. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.